Stan Hieronymus joins me this week for an in-depth discussion on hop chemistry and tropical flavors in beer. This is Beersmith Podcast number 172.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 172, and it's mid-June 2018. This week, Stan Hieronymus joins me for an in-depth discussion on hop chemistry and cutting-edge research in tropical and fruity hop flavors. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're running a great deal right now. Get 20% off your subscription when you use the code BEERSMITH2018. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers, and you can read my new column called Ask the Experts. Take advantage of their special deal when you use the offer code BEERSMITH2018 at beerandbrewing.com. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the new BrewVision thermometer from Blickman Engineering. This interactive wireless digital thermometer connects right to your iPhone or iPad and lets you remotely monitor and record temperatures. You can download recipes directly from the Beersmith Cloud and get updates and alerts as you brew. Get the BrewVision Bluetooth thermometer today, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 was just released. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with an integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit juice and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. You can get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com, and you can run it side-by-side with your old Beersmith software to compare. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Stan Hieronymus. Stan is the author of For the Love of Hops and has authored a number of other books, including Brewing Local, Brew Like a Monk, and Brewing with Wheat. Stan has penned hundreds of periodicals and is a certified beer judge. Stan, it is fantastic to have you back on the show.
Been too long.
It has. It's been, I was surprised it's been almost a year.
Yep.
So how have you been? Where have your travels taken you lately, Stan?
Well, last month I was in Peru. That was kind of fun, judging and speaking at a conference. And then some smaller trips around. I feel bad about talking about these things because your listeners go, geez, all he does is get to flit around to places and have fun.
Well, that is all you do, isn't it, Stan? Really?
Well, I do have fun and I do flit around. So
he's got a big pinball machine in the background there, too.
Yes, that's true. I haven't had much time. And the pinball machine needs a little bit of repair. I haven't had a chance to get to it. And then two things that people want to think about next year. A couple months ago, Urban Chestnut in St. Louis, where we lived until recently, held a historic lager fest. And so they were some of the best lager breweries around the country, made beers based upon Ron Pattinson's recipes. So a lot of stuff from the 19th century, but also some 20th century, like from
and
England.
Of course, I just mentioned Ron Pattinson is a historical beer expert, particularly English and Scottish styles, I think, right?
Yeah, and certainly German as well. So that was a really neat event, and they're going to do Lagerfest again next year. I don't know, probably March or April, maybe a different theme. But this idea that there's a kind of a lager revolution going on in the country, it'd be nice if it spreads beyond Pilsners. So far, it's been a lot of Pilsners with American hops, but going back to the traditional it's a pretty broad category. And then I, at the beginning, which for me was just this last weekend, in Morganton, North Carolina, which is about an hour from Asheville, Fauna Flora hosts what they call State of Origin, which is, again, breweries, a lot of breweries from across the country, mostly North Carolina breweries, making beers. All of the beers are made with a certain amount of local ingredients. So that's another really cool event. And I would say that one in particular belongs on anybody's bucket list.
And I'm trying to remember, you're in Atlanta now. You moved, right?
Yep, in Atlanta. So it's a little ways. We're you know, a little over 3 hours from Asheville, which is not too bad. And Atlanta itself is also booming new beer wise. So a lot of.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think I had Mitch Steele on a couple months ago, and he was talking about his new brewery there.
Yeah, the brewery itself is amazing. You know where it sits, the view from the rooftop brewery, and of course Mitch makes some pretty okay beers.
Yeah, he's not too bad at it.
Yeah.
Well, Stan, you wanted to do a deep dive into hop chemistry today, and we are going to go deep, I think. You wanted to talk about thiols, which honestly I don't know that much about. So why don't we start with explaining let's start at the very beginning. What, you know, thiols are an element in hops, right? They're one of the oils in hops, I believe. Why are they important?
Well, I think the bottom line for people as they try and figure out how are we getting tropical flavors, tropical aromas and flavors out of hops? It turns out thiols are a contributor to that. I got the press release from Firestone Walker yesterday about the latest in, you know, they have these series of beers with mostly experimental hops and from different parts of the world with the idea that you can get tropical flavors, citrus flavors, a variety of things in beer. And it's still just coming from the hops, or the hops, a combination of hops and yeast, of course. So thiols are an important component of that.
And, can you explain what thiols are? What are they actually?
They're also called mercaptans, and basically, they're an organic compound which has a sulfur atom, which is bound by a hydrogen atom. So that's what they are technically. In terms of essential oils, you think about essential oils in hops. And if we back up to when hops were just found growing wild before they were bred, so that those are hops like Hallertau, Mittelfrüh, Saaz, even Golding and Fuggel, as they were just selected, found, I'd like the hops on this side of the road better than the hops on that side of the road. I'm going to grow these hops. They contain maybe 1% of the hop is essential oils. That's a pretty small amount. In turn, the thiol compounds, if they're there at all, are maybe 1% of that.
So it's our 1% of 1%, right?
Yeah, at the high end.
Wow.
Of those hops, say a Saaz hop, they likely have virtually no thiols at all. Mm-hmm. So if we go back more than a million years, when hops were in Mongolia, some migrated into Europe, some came into North America. For whatever reason, those are different now. Is it just the genome, or is it an environmental factor? That's not exactly clear. In any event, hops with American background are more likely to have those thiols. So, and at the same time, we bred hops to have a larger amount of oils. So you can get something, like Ikuanot probably has about 3% of the hop is essential oils. Again, still only a small amount of that is going to be the thiols. But it's a tiny amount, and I think the easiest way, which I credit Scott LaFontaine, who's a graduate, a PhD candidate at Oregon State University, who's doing some research into these right now, and as he points out, basically what's there is the same as trying to, it's like the head of a pin in an Olympic swimming pool.
That's not much volume there.
Right, but our ability to perceive them is also can be, you can perceive it at about 6.006 parts per million, I think it is. So basically, it only needs a certain amount of parts per trillion, and you would perceive that. As opposed to, say, some essential oils like linalool, then it's 55 parts per million, which is a heck of a lot more than 0.006. So you perceive them at much lower levels. Everything happens, and that's why they're hard to measure and figure out exactly what their impact is.
So you mentioned some of the other aromatic oils. What are how do those sort of fit in with thiol?
Well, so if we go back about 30 years and linalool, which I think most people have are familiar with, and that's, it can give you a little bit of orangey tangerine-y character and just something people smell it and they go, ooh, hoppy. That was identified as a key element in hops. And so you began to focus more when people are breeding to get hops with more linalool in them. Over time, what was recognized is there is no single compound that dictates what we consider hoppy aroma. There are 500 compounds in hops. They work together, what the scientists like to call synergy. When Citra became, actually shortly after Citra was released, and people said, boy, this is an exciting different hop, scientists at Sapporo in Japan took one look at it and they said, look at the combination of oils in this. And what they noticed is, as well as the linalool, it had a pretty high level of geraniol. And they began investigating and they said, coriander looks a lot like this. So they brewed beers with Citra. And instead of putting Citra in at that point, they put in coriander. And they got much of the same citrus quality. They also still had a beer that tasted of coriander. So it's not like you can start substituting coriander for Citra hops. And when they examined this, they noticed what was taking place is you were creating more citronellyl. Citronellyl is one of those 500 compounds, 500 plus compounds, but it's at a very low level. During the fermentation process, you got more citronellyl, and that gave it more of a citrus lime quality. And then they began investigating. They said, okay, what other hops are high in these? They did more experiments, and they showed that sure enough, we were getting a more tropical flavor when we tracked down hops that were high in linalool or geraniol because you could put the two together. They first reported that part, unfortunately, right about the time For the Love of Hops came out in 2012. So I read that report as the book was literally rolling off the presses. And after I quit crying, I began telling homebrewers, when I talk to homebrewers, you're not going to get everything you get in Citra, but it's sort of fun to look at something, a hop that isn't appreciated. Nugget would be an example. A nugget is high in linalool. And then take Chinook, which is high in geraniol. Put those two hops together, basically at knockout or in dry hopping, and see what kind of aromas and flavors you get. And sure enough, people were getting something that was fruitier and more tropical. Well, of course, it's really nice to know what works. We should be careful about saying this is why it works, because there was more going on. Since then, the researchers at Sapporo then began looking at thiols. And there was an understanding that thiols are definitely a contributor to the tropical aspect. Mm-hmm. So you had some American brewers looking for hops that are pretty high in the thiols. And the first one that was identified, so if we go to 2007, is the first aroma and flavor, hop aroma and flavor symposium at Oregon State University. And there, a researcher from Japan, not from Sapporo, was the first one to really begin to say, look, these particular hops are high in 4-MMP. Summit was one of them, for instance. So 4-MMP was identified in hops. It's obviously in hops.
What's 4-MMP, just so we can put it all together
here? Yeah, so 4-MMP is 4-MCAPO, 4-methylpentane, 2-1. That's why we say 4-MMP. And And I'll bring in another confusing fact here in a moment. But you began to know some hops were higher in 4-MMP. Cascade was another example. Citra was another example. All hops of American heritage. Not every hop of American heritage has it, but those were the hops that obviously did. Backing up for a moment, as we pointed out, they are at such low levels, and what it takes in a lab to isolate them is very expensive. And also, maybe slightly dangerous isn't the right word, but it involves chemicals that you don't necessarily want to be working with.
So, I mean, that's a factor here, though, too. It's really, really hard to measure these thiols, right?
Yep, and very expensive. So there hasn't been much so far. And there weren't real complete lists. There were rather short lists. So a new hop would come out like Citra, and we go, okay, that's high in 4-MMP. You know, Cascade turns out it has a fair amount, a level of 4-MMP.
Now, is 4-MMP a thiol? I'm trying to remember here.
4-MMP is a thiol.
Okay, it is. So, yeah. So that's a piece I was missing, I guess.
Yeah. So, and it basically you know, what you would say, it smells of ribes. Uh-huh. Or a tomato plant, the plant, not tomatoes. And at higher levels, it comes across as catty, which is, of course, litter box.
Yeah.
So this is when the first crosses, if we go back to the beginning of the 20th century, actually the cross is 1917, the hop is released in the 1930s, and that's Brewer's Gold. It's a hop that you can get now. When Brewer's Gold, and this cross was made in England, the English brewers would smell this hop and they're going, I cannot use this in dry hop because this, what they actually referred to as American twang, which was catty and ribey. And so it was bad. And people breeders spent the next 60 years trying to avoid it. Only recently, when you had heavily late hop beers, and this interest in bigger, bolder flavors, occasionally dank, then people began to appreciate that character. And that's why we're examining it now. The people in wine have known about thiols longer and have been researching it longer, primarily for Sauvignon Blanc. A difference between hops and grapes is hops may have thiols in a free form. So you can have a precursor or it can be in the free form. And the precursor, obviously, it's going to have to, something during your process has to change it. In the case of grapes to wine, we know it's part of fermentation. And there are yeasts that you can get that are even better at it. The people in wine are not nearly, the people in wine use GMO yeast. People in beer do not use GMO yeast. So we are not out there trying to use Clipper to change yeast so they're better at processing these compounds. Again, in the case of beer, you've got some of the 4-MMP is in free form, and that's what we know the most about because although it's expensive and difficult to measure, there have been a fair amount of efforts now where we can make a list and realizing what I should have given you to put on the screen for people is a list of high 4-MMP hops.
Okay. Well, we'll discuss those very shortly here.
I did want to
ask you though, how does this fit in with, you know, the sort of biotransformations that are happening when people starting to hop during active fermentation? Are we seeing some, you know, are the thiols somehow related to that overall process?
That's a fine question. And one that right now, when we talk about biotransformations, we know those are real.
I'm talking about actually adding hops during active fermentation, which is, right. You know, a technique that's used quite a bit. In fact, I had Randy Mosher on a few weeks ago talking about doing Northeastern New England IPAs with that technique.
Right. And right now, we can say, I'm going to do this and I get this result. The why behind it is not
fully understood yet.
Identified. Exactly. It's not understood. And so I'm cautious. Yes, there are biotransformations. And I wrote about a little bit in For the Love of Pops. We don't know at this point, because what happens when you continue it to every time you add that yeast, or, you know, during fermentation, it's not just the hops that are changing, you know, that you're also changing. You're creating different esters with the interaction of the yeast and the wort that you produced. Mm-hmm. So it's a really complex matrix. So do the thiols change? Perhaps, because at that point you're taking the thiols that were in the precursor form and you're transforming them. And in fact, which has not been examined at all. And so I started. So in 2007, you had the conference in Oregon State. 10 years later, they had another conference, which was last July. Almost half the presentations were related to thiols. And you had research in Germany, research in Japan, research in France, which is Neosis, which is otherwise a lab that does research on wine, and research in Belgium. So you have, and of course, the United States. So you have all of these people looking at thiols now. Well, in the course of this, Neosis does this studies of barley and sees that there are precursors for these thiols in barley as well.
Interesting. So potentially you could be getting some of it from the wort, I guess.
Exactly.
And interesting.
That hasn't been examined. So,
I do know a lot of brewers have had success using many of the same hops that you're talking about, hops that are high in geraniol and have thiols and so on, particularly some of the ones from, New Zealand and so on, using those during active fermentation and getting a lot of these fruity tropical flavors that you're talking about, right?
Right. Exactly. And, but a key thing is when you're taking something that's high in geraniol, which that the biotransformation there, we know that geraniol with pheromonal linalool creates more citronella, and citronella is limey and citrusy. So, that's an example of the effect that's going on. Now, where's the thiol fit in? Not exactly. So backing up, when I would tell homebrewers, why don't you try something high in linalool and high in geraniol? Almost any time you take a hop that's high in geraniol, it's a good chance it has thiols. So that was working, but we didn't know the exact reason why. Mm-hmm. So Sapporo, going back in, and what they've done is they have actually isolated the compounds. So they would, because you can look at, for instance, the linalool, geraniol, and citronellal in Bravo, which is a way underappreciated hop because it brings those things to the table. It does not have thiols in free form at a very low level. Mm. But they would look at Bravo and say Mosaic or Citra, and it does not come across as a single hop beer nearly as tropical. So they're wondering why.
So maybe the thiols, huh?
There's a thiol. So what they would take, they'd take a compound, this sort of a cocktail of linalool, geraniol, and citronellal, and you can look at that at a spider graph, just a 5-6 stars, and we'll say the lower one is tropical, and you got to sort of envision this in your mind if you're familiar with spider graphs. You take the thiol or MMP they were using, and you see tropical goes down to maybe 3 out of 5. You take that cocktail of linalool, geraniol, and citronellal, and that goes down to 3. You put those two together, and tropical goes down to 5. So it's clearly an interaction at that point. Doesn't need to be an interaction with yeast. That isn't exactly true, because we know that you need the interaction of yeast for those other essential oils. We don't know if you need it for the thiol, but it certainly works with the thiol. So, as I said, the wine people have known about this longer. Well, they approached it from the standpoint of trying to enhance the thiols. And there are basically 3 thiols that they've isolated. So that's where beer research has started, and I won't give you the full names of those. Just you've got, as I said, there's four MMP, which, because research has come from other directions, sometimes you will see as 4SMP. It's the same thing. If you're in a lab, not totally the same thing, because if you're in a lab and you're going to run these things through mass spectrometry, then you need to know the standards. So some people might buy a standard for 4MSP, for 4MMP, but that is the same thiol. And the other two are 3MH, which is prominent in Nelson solvent, as a matter of factor, and 3MHA. So the wine people were looking at this from thiols. What they began to understand is when they had linalool and geraniol, that's when they got a Sauvignon Blanc that people preferred.
Interesting. So maybe a combination of the three, huh?
Right.
Of course, you said they often occur together in the hop anyways, right?
Right. Exactly. So it's not the exact why behind what is happening is a mystery. That it can work with these hops, is certainly we see proof of that.
Awesome. Well, in your paper, you also talk about a concept called thiol potency. What does that mean?
Well, this is Neosis, which is the lab in France. So they've recognized that you do have these bound thiols. So you would ask yourself, for instance, Citra has both. And you could just use it at a dry hop. And in fact, at a dry hop, probably you don't need to be doing it clear through fermentation. And you're going to get the impact. You have others like, say, Calypso, which has almost no free thiols, but it has a lot of bound thiols. So that you would want to add, you want to have that in interaction with the yeast. So they'd like to put a number. So you've got two numbers there, really. One is the total thiol potency, but the other is where you would use it. So
that's the free thiols, I guess, versus the bound ones.
Oh, well, they actually give a number. So I forget the exact number. Calypso might be 112, and Citra might be 69. That's definitely not the number. But it turns out that Citra is easier for you to use. So that's just the beginnings. And at the same time, again, researchers at Sapporo, what they're beginning to look at is bound geraniol and free geraniol. It's easier to measure free of anything.
Interesting.
There's a whole lot that, how much you need to know. It certainly makes it easier to do your first formulation for a recipe.
Well, we're getting down in the weeds now, but I wanted to ask, maybe take this back to the beginning and say, well, what kind of hops do have the characteristics that we're talking about here? What are some of the hops that are accessible to homebrewers that we might be able to use to make these sort of fruity tropical IPAs?
Well, they're the ones people would have a pretty good guess. In terms of high levels, you've got Citra, Simcoe, Eureka, Summit, which of course is another hop that I think is way underappreciated. Apollo, Topaz, Mosaic, Equinot, Galaxy, Nelson Sauvin, and Vic Secret. I would not be surprised if, whatever the next hop that comes out of Australia is, will almost surely be high in thiols. We had at a different thing I was at a few weeks ago, we had a bunch of experimental hops and two experimentalists from Australia, and they are, they were on the verge of caddy to caddy. But in the right combination, that's what gives you super tropical.
So the why are the hops out of New Zealand and Australia such big character? Do they have such big thiol content here?
Well, because if you look back in their breeding program, they have American in their background. You don't have to have a large amount of American. If you just look at the breeding of a hop, it doesn't take an immense amount. And part of this has to do with the sexual activity of hops when they're breeding, because they can create something almost entirely new. And Citra, for instance, Citra's mother is Hallertau Middelfrüh. So that's
interesting.
Citra is 50% Middelfrüh, and it's more than 20% Fuggle, another Landrace hop. Mm-hmm. It's 17% Brewer's Gold. Brewer's Gold in turn is one half American, one half either Golding or Fuggle. So that's 8% American. And then it's got 3% unknown, which is almost surely of American background. So that gives you an idea. It's probably that hop is 1/8 American in its background. So the breeding programs in Australia and New Zealand didn't operate exactly the same, but they both start with American stock, either cluster or cascade.
Is there anything about the region there that may contribute as well, or is it primarily just the hop genetics?
Oh, all genetics, of course, rely on what are known as epigenetics, which changes that based upon what the wine people call terroir. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly true both in Australia and New Zealand. So that's the other thing. And then another factor is, the Australians were certainly ahead of the curve in thinking about how they were going to process their hops and drying them in a way where you were careful to preserve the oils as much as you could, drying them at a lower temperature, which is certainly taking place in the American Northwest now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, where do you see the research going next, Stan?
Well, it's funny. Tom Nielsen, who is, of course, both hops and malt and all things ingredients at Sierra Nevada, was speaking in American Society for Brewing Chemist meetings. It was a malt meeting this week. And it's funny. One thing he said was, does technology need to catch up to theory, or theory need to catch up to technology? And the case right now, I think, with the knowledge brewers would like to have is we need for technology to catch up with technology. That means as researchers are able to identify the importance of these compounds, but the other aspect is we don't know yet if the amount of a compound, how much difference that makes. Certainly, if you keep loading Citra would be an example. You put enough Citra in it late, more people are going to identify it as caddy.
Interesting.
And it depends upon the levels you perceive it. When Sierra Nevada was first brewing with Citra, and then it was an experimental hop, as a matter of fact, back in 2007, their panelists, the women on the panel who are women perceive things at lower levels would almost always call their test beers caddy, and the men would almost always call their test beers tropical. So that's the level you're sitting at. But anyway, as you add, you can go to a certain level, and you would end up with caddy. So that would be one thing that people would like to know. Is it enough to know that the hop almost always say Eureka, which is a proprietary hop from Hopsteiner, is going to have a high level of 4-MMP? Then, or do I need to know that it's X parts per trillion? That is not clear right now. Right now, brewers, if you're getting this at a commercial scale, buying your hops from almost any hop broker, there's a good chance you know what percentage of geraniol it has and what percentage of linalool it has. Mm-hmm. So you can begin to identify hops that are high in those things. You might have to do the math yourself, because it'll say, okay, this is 1.8% oils and it's 0.08. geraniol. So you want to figure out how many parts per trillion is in there, and that you set up your spreadsheet, and that'd be easy enough. Homebrewers don't have that information yet.
We're getting there.
Maybe they will eventually. Yeah. And certainly when you, it's there, whoever bought those hops from, whether it's from YCH Hops or Hollingberry, has that information. But when a homebrewer supplier buys those hops, breaks it into smaller packages, they don't necessarily pass that along. And it would not be hard to do. I know when you buy it from Hollingberry, you get a QR code, and they are running the specs on every lot of hops.
Do they have the thiol content?
Do not have the thiols. No,
they don't. Yeah, because it's too hard to measure, right?
It's right. So there are researchers now who have proposed easier ways to measure the thiols, but those have not been accepted as a standard at all. And it's important to also recognize that we aren't done even finding out what thiols there are in hops. Started with what wine knew, but now it's right there. There's a one called 3-sulfane-4-methylpentane-1-ol, and that's really grapefruit-like, and it's prominent in Amarillo, Hallertau Blanc, Nelson Sauvignon, and Mosaic and Ikuanot. So that's a real cross section of things. You know, why is it there in Hallertau Blanc, which is a daughter of Cascade, bred in Germany? That's not exactly clear. And you know, I would not be at all surprised, and I don't remember the number. It's from the hop breeding company, and it's a daughter of Sabro. Sabro is the hop they just released this year, which was 438, the hop that was only the homebrew community before. And boy, I tell you that the daughter certainly has this real citrus grapefruit quality, and it makes you think it may well contain that particular thiol. But backing up, even so, for instance, to do mass spec at a top notes level, in other words, the least expensive mass spec, then the machinery is going to cost you like $25,000 to $50,000, and then each time you run it, it's going to be at least $30, and then to do it at the high end, then you're at like $175,000 and close to $100 to run every lot. And that's just so you would have refined these other essential oils, where we aren't even at thiols at that point.
Interesting. Well, Stan, what advice do you have for homebrewers that are looking to get these tropical citrus flavors into their beers in terms of either hops used or technique?
Well, I think in terms of the hops used, you know, you can identify the ones that are highest, find ones that work for you. So for instance, if we say, you know, I listed the high levels, but you've got significant, I'll just read off a few more, which are Zeus, Cluster, Chinook, Cascade, Centennial, Amarillo, German Northern Brewer, Hallertau Blanc, German Cascade, and Mandarina Bavaria, and then Polaris.
And those are sort of a medium group. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they're significant. Okay. You know, then measurable would be more like Calypso would be an example. Now, Calypso, maybe we're going to find out you can use it in other ways. The hop formerly known as Denali, which may be known as Denali again, that's from Hopsteiner. Mm-hmm. And they've got a trademark issue going on. So they've gone back to giving it its experimental number, which I do not remember because they get 5-digit numbers. But anyway, there's a Lemon Drop, another example. I think Lemon Drop, and this would be a whole nother topic, Lemon Drop has a couple compounds that some researchers in Great Britain identified that I haven't seen anyplace else. And of course, Lemon Drop is, and those researchers are the ones that came up with the a blend of Cascade and Lemon Drop, which is meant to simulate Citra. And so it makes you wonder, you know, how they were only looking at, when we talk about linalool, geraniol, citronellal, nerol, all these ones that people may have heard of, those are all oxygenated compounds, not thiols. Mm. So the oxygenated compounds is where they're easier to recognize. There are standards for those, and you can run mass spec on them. So that's been examined a lot more. And they came up with that you know, substitute for Citra simply by examining the oxygenated compounds. Of course, what happened is they're suggested one happened to contain thiols.
Interesting. So
it shows you how we can make things work even when we don't know exactly how they work. So from a homebrew standpoint, I would say, you know, when you use, say, Chinook, then you're getting those same things. So be willing to look, and that is if you don't want to be buying, spending the money, or cannot get something like Citra or Galaxy. Galaxy's the worst example. Galaxy and Nelson Sauvin are the worst example because those two hops are really difficult to get.
Yeah.
These days, you can get almost any American variety. There are plenty of those out there. But if you want fun things and doing the crossover, then be looking at those hops that are higher in linalool and geraniol, and just figure out, it depends where you're buying them from, but say, hey, can you get me at least a linalool and geraniol information on these?
And quite often you can. In fact, I think most of the varieties, they have published information, at least at a base level for them, right?
Yeah, it's an important thing. You know, and those are there, and you can, you know, Scott Janish has a list, for instance. But a tricky thing is that list is, you know, a one-time assay.
Right.
You know, so you can take, you know, Sierra Nevada a couple of years ago that they were looking at, and literally like every 3 days in the field, and, you know, within 12 days, the oils in Cascade will like quadruple. So, and nobody's going to be picking them so early, you get that lower amount, but it really depends upon when they're picked and how they're dried. That's why it would be nice to have that hop analyzed post-processing.
Yeah.
Right now, we're looking for a broader spectrum.
And then in terms of techniques, do you have any specific techniques that might help bring out the tropical aromas and flavors?
Well, so boiling for 10 minutes, you'll boil off half of your essential oils.
Right.
So basically, additions at zero on is what you want to aim for.
You're talking,
you
know, primarily whirlpool steeping or dry hopping, right?
Exactly. And then if you want to experiment with fermentation during dry hopping and see what happens, then take really good notes. What I've been telling people, if you want to begin to understand what's going on, when those hops, before you use them, I'm operating on the assumption that people are using pellets. Although they could be using cryohops. Cryohops change the equation at all, and there's a lot of research that needs to be done on the impact there, because it can also change the perception of bitterness. That's a topic for another time.
Yeah, cryohops are used primarily whirlpool and dry hopping, though, right?
Yeah. Right.
Primarily.
When you do that, part of the issue is, of course, they float to the top. So the one tip I throw in there is when you are dry hopping with cryo, if you use some pellets as well, then they'll cling to the pellets. Mm-hmm. So you get the effect of the cryo and just a little bit of pellets in there as well. When you first get those hops, you can take those pellets and grind them up and smell them. And choose whatever elements you want to look for. So tropical, onion, garlic, floral, whether you get red fruits or green fruits. But keep it fairly simple, like 5 to 7 of those, and mark that down on a scale, say 1 to 5. And assess it then. Assess it, whatever you use in the boil before you or in the whirlpool, again, take a little bit of wort and smell it, then cool it and taste it and see how it's changed. Then in your dry hopping process, if you do it partway through dry hopping, then you've got another change, a little bit of wort out. So keep assessing that hop all the way along and you begin to understand how it's changing. So in the raw form, post-boil, during dry hopping, post-dry hopping, and then eventually in your beer. and you'll begin to understand what's going on with your hops that way. And the unfortunate thing is, the next time you get, say, Centennial or Cascade, they're probably going to be a little bit different.
Right, but right.
Right now, those are the breaks of the game.
So I just wanted to mention again the active fermentation piece. When do you recommend, I get this question a lot, when do you recommend adding hops during active fermentation? Are you doing it at high krausen? Are you doing it after that? I know there's always this trade-off because, you know, you got this CO2 bubbling through there, pushing a lot of the aromas out, right?
Yeah, the CO2 will definitely blow off some of the aroma. What I would recommend is do those different ones in your setup. So do one at, and particularly if you're evaluating along the way, so you're hitting all those marks and you've got something you can go back and look at, do one time at high krausen and then the next time right after high krausen. So you can see, what am I losing? What am I gaining?
That's right. Right after peak fermentation, if you will. Yeah.
Right. And then you could also do it at that point after basically, you know, say you're one Play-Doh from final gravity. That'd be another place because you still got plenty of yeast cells there. Mm-hmm. You know, you're probably going to get it. It's going to be an ongoing thing, even when you're bottle conditioning.
Interesting. Okay. Well, Stan, I do really appreciate you coming on the show again. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, you know, when you invite me, I'll be back.
It's a great pleasure to have, and I should mention, I'm going to push Stan's book here, For the Love of Hops. I just threw it up on the screen. My guest today was the one and only Stan Hieronymus. Stan is author of many popular brewing books, including Brewing Local, For the Love of Hops, and one of my personal favorites, Brew Like a Monk. Thank you again, Stan. Great to have you on the show.
Thanks again for having me.
Well, a big thank you to Stan Hieronymus for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue is packed with great information for homebrewers and craft beer fans. Take advantage of their fantastic sale and get 20% off when you use the offer code BEERSMITH2018 at beerandbrewing.com. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the innovative new BrewVision wireless thermometer. Remotely monitor your brewing system from your iPhone or iPad, record data, set alerts, and grab recipes directly from the BeerSmith cloud. The BrewVision thermometer, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, BeerSmith 3 just launched, just in time for Father's Day. BeerSmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new whirlpool options, support for high-altitude brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out BeerSmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from BeerSmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.